The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the podcast that follows the money behind the beautiful game and is currently looking down the back of football's sofa for some loose change. I'm Kevin Day, and joining me from the Devil's County of Sussex, fresh from a 24-hour virtual Eurovision party, is lecturer in football finance at Liverpool University, Kieran Maguire. Hello, Kieran. How was Eurovision for you?
Oh, well, it's great because ABBA won it in Brighton, didn't they?
Did they? I didn't know.
And I had a photograph of Agnetha taken with an old black and white camera that I took when she was walking down Brighton seafront in 1973, 74. Yeah, great memories for me because I was at a certain age.
Did Agnetha know you were taking the photograph?
No, I was. If tagging had been legal in those days, I suspect I might have been wearing one.
Do you know what, Kieran? Like many things I say on this pod, what I think is going to be a seemingly innocent introduction suddenly turns very sinister for no apparent reason. Well, the reason is that you are a man with a history. Anyway, it's Monday, Kieran, which means, of course, questions. But a couple of stories first, and a couple of big stories as well. On Friday, League Two clubs decided to end the season. It seems to general relief, and it was unanimous, apparently. Still to be ratified by the EFL and the FA. May mean a reprieve for Stevenage, but it seems, as with the National League, that most League Two clubs are relieved that they don't have to bear the financial burden of finishing the season without any fans.
That's right. I decided to take a look at just how bad things were in League Two. The average losses in that division are £800,000 a year. So, you know, clubs are struggling. It's estimated it will cost you £140,000 for the COVID testing for players if matches did return. And clubs simply don't have the money. There are a few things that are outstanding. They've not quite worked out how they're going to do the playoffs as yet. There's got to be approval from both the FA and the EFL board. And I think that could be an issue for Stevenage, because I think the FA are worried that it might set a precedent. You enter a league with the idea of promotion and relegation. We're also hearing that clubs in the Championship might vote against it. They could potentially veto it, because they fear it might set a precedent for the Premier League. If some of the clubs in that division say, well, if you're doing it in the EFL, why can't we do it in the Premier League as well? So we're not done and dusted by far, but certainly the top three appear to be up. I thought there was some very magnanimous behaviour. Port Vale, who are eighth, you know, they're one place off a playoff. They took the view, that their owner took the view, that it's more important to have all the clubs, and they know what it's like to be at a small club, it's a good day out in Port Vale if anybody's ever been there. They said that's more important than them potentially getting promotion, a standpoint which isn't being shared in League One, where I think it's fair to say civil war is taking place.
Yeah, we'll move on to that. Before we start, I hate to be picky, but no one has a good day out in Port Vale, because there is no such place as Port Vale. As you know, they are the only football club in England named after a place that doesn't exist. They're in Burslem. No one particularly knows why they're called Port Vale. It's interesting that Port Vale's chairman spoke about being almost physically sick, shaking with relief, with nerves beforehand and relief afterwards. Taking the promotion relegation issues aside, as we are a financial football pod, on a purely financial basis, most clubs in League Two seem to be suggesting, as with the National League clubs, especially Dulwich Hamlet that we spoke about, that this probably has saved them financially, this decision.
Very much so. And I think there's a just as big a decision as to when they're going to come back. Because realistically, clubs in League Two, that they're getting 40 to 50% of their income comes through the turnstiles. So yeah, you can't return to football unless you've got money coming in to pay the wages and paying the overheads. League Two, potentially, have we seen it, the last of it, until 2021?
Although there is an argument that I've seen put forward in League Two clubs in particular, they still have standing terracing, some of them. So it might be easier to social distance at some of those clubs and to get people back in some way, shape or form, and whether it's better or not to have 500 people rather than 2,000 people, I don't know. That's a decision for the future. But at that level, it seems to me that it is more doable than it is at a 50,000 all-seater stadium, isn't it?
Yes. And there is the potential. I'm just thinking, look at the major costs. We've got the wage costs. I think the wage costs in League Two will come down significantly this summer because there's 1,400 footballers out of contract.
Yeah.
Market forces apply. And, as somebody that sort of knows a little bit about the economic side of things, it's going to have a very big hit. You can't offer big wages. And I think clubs will be focusing on survival rather than promotion.
Now, just briefly on the Stevenage thing, Kieran, I was listening to 6:06 on Saturday night, which was a mistake. It wasn't deliberate on my part. I just happened to turn it on, and for some reason it was on Radio 5 and not Radio 3. And I thought I'd listen to the chimps as they spoke about the football, and it was quite interesting for 2 minutes. I understand Chris Sutton's argument that it's only fair that teams that are in the top three should be promoted without playing the rest of the games. I don't understand his argument that it's also fair that teams that are in the bottom three should be relegated without... Because if Stevenage could still have stayed up, I think it's really unfair that they go down purely because of the financial impact of not being promoted is nowhere near the financial impact of being relegated, is it? So I think there is an argument, especially with Bury missing, so you could promote Barrow just as a one-off. I can't see the issue. I know Stevenage have had a terrible season, but I don't see why some pundits especially, are throwing the toys out of their pram, particularly about Stevenage.
Yeah, it does seem a strange one. I think we've sort of had this discussion before that we both want football to survive and for there to be the potential of 92 clubs next season. Who those clubs actually are, we'll sort out at a later date. Getting excited about things of this nature now is pure self-interest. I know that the clubs who were potentially in playoff positions in the National League were hoping for some form of playoff to take place, as it is going to take place in League Two, yeah. With a view to picking up a second promotion spot. So therefore, that would have implications for Stevenage.
Now, as you said, League One haven't made any agreement. They're meeting again next week. Six clubs in particular, Peterborough, Oxford, Sunderland, Fleetwood, Portsmouth and Ipswich, are very keen, they said, to continue the season and to see it finish competitively. It may or may not be coincidence that five of those clubs are in the top seven and one of them is in the top ten. So again, and I don't blame any of these clubs, and I don't blame any of the fans of these clubs for wanting it to happen. There's more of an element of self-interest here because, of course, they want the season finished because they've got a chance of going up. Two of them, I think, would go up if the season were to be cleared null and void. But what's your instinct on what will happen in League One? Are League One clubs financially more in a position to be able to finish games behind closed doors?
Not really. Andy Holt he's been on Twitter, as is Andy's sort of style. Yeah. From his point of view, where's he going to get 140 grand from to conduct the testing? And ultimately, what's more important in 12 months, in 3 years' time, is it the existence of the club or it's having a tilt at promotion for this season? The reason why there isn't a different approach being taken between League One and League Two is that if you go up from League Two to League One, you get around about an extra £500,000 in prize money, in TV money, whereas if you go from League One to the Championship, it's about £7 million. And of course, you've then got the benefits of hosting You know, Forest, Borough. Yeah, there's lots of big sides in that division. You know, I'm assuming that Leeds and West Brom will go up one way or the other. But even so, yeah, we could have Villa coming down, and the chances for, you know, the likes of Peterborough to be able to selling out their away end every week is tempting. So it is self-interest. I've got, again, I'm the same as you. I've got no interest in it. Got no objection to it. But what does grate a bit is where they're trying to claim that this sporting integrity comments. It's not. You know, let's just say, be honest. You know, we want to go up. We've got a chance of going up. We can make a lot of money from going up. And that's why we're doing it.
Yeah, to be fair, though, in terms of integrity, there are clubs in League Two and League One who are saying, particularly in the Northwest, who are saying, look, towns in that area, people are not getting tested. So they're reluctant to spend money on testing footballers when, for the want of a better word, normal people aren't being tested. And also, this the health and safety document that the EFL have released is 47 pages long. There are about 350 things that the clubs have to do to be able to play the games, and all of them cost money, which it's fine for the EFL to say, well, these are guidelines, but not to say, okay, if you can't afford the guidelines, we'll help you. And they're not. There's no suggestion that the EFL are actually offering any financial help to clubs to play these games behind closed doors. And also, of course, all the players that are on furlough will have to be paid wages by the clubs.
Yeah, I mean, the EFL's coffers are bare. You know, they've already advanced all the money that they do have to as a sticking plaster approach. But you know, they admitted themselves that it's just kicking this problem down the road, and there's an enormous black hole arriving. Is hibernation a better choice? Well, that ultimately comes down to the individual clubs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't, does it? Because there has to be a majority to agree. In Scotland, Partick Thistle have decided to refund season ticket holders. Can you give us a suggestion of why they're doing that, and also what sort of numbers we're looking at and how much it will cost Partick Thistle?
Well, Partick Thistle are in the Championship. I think they're due to get relegated to the division below. So they're not happy about that. They were one of the dissenting clubs when they had the votes in Scotland. Partick have got 1,800 season ticket holders. So potentially it could have cost them around about 80 grand. But of those 1,800 season ticket holders, only 64 took up the offer of a refund. And all the others have said, we want you to survive. So, you know, those people that can afford to not take the refund appear to have taken a collective decision that we want a Partick, most of all, to be able to support. And, you know, fair play to them. Equally, I think the 64 people who have taken it back, I'm sure many of those will have lost jobs and will be desperate for every penny they can get. So you shouldn't castigate them, but you've got to give a lot of credit. I think it worked out as 97.5% of the fan base said, we're not getting anything the rest of this season, but we don't want our money back.
Okay, that's interesting, because I assume when I read the notes, and not the research, obviously, I just read the notes and the questions. There's a little insight into how this pod works. I assume that Partick had refunded all their season ticket holders, so it's just the 64 that wanted a refund.
That's right, and I think a few other clubs are taking a similar approach. I think Manchester United have written to their fans and said you can either have refunds or you can roll over the unexpired part into your season ticket for next season. So more and more clubs are now getting in contact with fans. I know, you know, Brighton have done something similar. So I've got an email and you make a decision. And I think it's a choice of take a refund. You can leave the money with the club, or quite a few of the clubs are sort of set up charities and you effectively hand the money across to the charity.
Yeah, I don't think there should be any blame attached to the 64 Partick Thistle season ticket holders. We don't understand their financial circumstances. And also, if, you know, in our world, for example, if BT send me an email saying, look, we've not been able to provide you with any live sport. Do you want a month off credit wise? You go, yeah, fine. I'll have a month off credit-wise then. Yeah. You know, they offered me this, you know, you can watch third division German football cheaper next year. It's like, no, you know, I'll just, the first option was month off credit-wise. So it's fine. As it happens, God bless BT and German football. They are back today. I never thought I'd be so excited by sitting in front of two games in front of empty German stadiums with I even went for a bottle of German wine just to make it authentic. And good games they were too. Now, this next story, it's difficult not to be cynical about this. Now, Stevenage and Macclesfield have been charged by the EFL.
Yep.
First of all, can you clarify what for? And second, is it really cynical for me to suggest that the reason the EFL are charging them now is because they think they may not be, for one reason or another, in the EFL in 3 months' time?
I think these proceedings did commence some time, and especially in the case of Macclesfield, they are a serial offender. So just to run through the charges, what happened with Stevenage is that the club postponed a match in, I think it was in November. And the reason why that they postponed it is that they had three international call-ups, or so they claimed at the time. One of their lads was due to play for Antigua and Barbuda, and subsequently he wasn't required. So it all got into a bit of a kerfuffle about when emails were sent, how they were sent, who they were received by, and so on. But the EFL were quite strict on this. They wanted a points deduction and a 15K fine. And it then went to tribunal, and the charges were dismissed, and it only took 15 minutes to find a verdict in Stevenage's favour, which does seem, right. You know, I don't know whether you've ever been on jury service, but yeah, you don't have enough time for a cup of tea and a biscuit to make your mind up with regards there. So it does seem perhaps a bit of a spurious prosecution by the EFL. Having said that, the guy who was Stevenage's lawyer, and I think he's mentioned his name before, this guy Nick DeMarco, he's Joey Barton's QC, yeah. He's Tyson Fury's QC, yeah, yeah. And so on. He is the number one man to go for. You know, he represented Stevenage and clearly put forward a very compelling case.
How did Stevenage afford him? I mean, you've told me off camera, how showbiz does that sound? You've told me off Zoom that how expensive he is. I mean, that's a lot of money for a club like Stevenage, isn't it? Just by the by.
Well, so's a £15,000 fine. So yeah, you know, the potential for a further points deduction. You know, if they do get relegated, you lose the solidarity payments from the Premier League. You lose half of the EFL. You do get parachute payments in the National League, but you lose half of those as well. So it is a costly experience to get relegated. So I think Stevenage were doing what they felt was anything to give them any chance of staying up.
I have done jury duty, by the way. It was full on 12 angry men. They made me foreman of the jury because one of them recognised me off the telly, so he thought I'd be able to speak all right. And then it was quite clear that the chap being prosecuted hadn't done it, except for one woman who decided that he looked like a wrong'un, and therefore he probably needed. So it took a long time, but yeah, I'm not giving any details. So Macclesfield, serial offenders, but is this a new specific charge, or is this to do with the on-running non-payment of players, manager, Sol Campbell, etc.?
Well, I think it's a mixture of things. That they had an earlier charge. They'd had a 6-point penalty and 4 suspended earlier in the season. They then didn't pay their wages in February. There was a match that was called off. They were due to play Plymouth, and they called it off at very short notice because I think the players had refused to play, and also they couldn't get a safety certificate. So, Plymouth were out of pocket because clearly it's not a match where you can just schlep up. That's the case for most away games for Plymouth. So overall, they've now had a total deduction of 11 points this season, with a further 2 points suspended, which, given the precarious nature of what we're seeing at the bottom of League Two, the gap between Macclesfield and Stevenage is now very, very tight indeed. They had to go and pay £10,000 in legal fees to the EFL. So that's half a day's work probably for whoever was representing them. But I mean, to be fair to the legal eagles, our silver tongues friends, 800 pages of evidence for this particular case, which is quite staggering.
800?
800, yes.
That's more than your book.
That's more than about 10 of my book.
There will be people listening to this, Kieran, who we've talked about this previously, and I've noticed the nature of some tweets recently about various other EFL cases going on. But there will be people listening to this who assume that, given the current circumstances, the EFL would just let's forget any charges for now until next season. But that's not the case.
No. I think these are ongoing. I think they're deemed to be separate from the issues with relation to COVID-19. Of course, we've still got the two outstanding charges against Sheffield Wednesday and Derby.
Yeah.
And how long it's going to take those to be resolved is open to question, because the potential points deductions there are quite significant. So I'm sure both parties are trying to put forward as strong a case as possible and again, gathering up these hundreds of pages of this, that and the other.
Right. Now, I'm aware that you have, I was going to say media interests, so we have to crack on, but they're not media interests, they're actually work interests. You're lecturing to China, aren't you?
That's right. That's right. We've got a partner university in China. They normally come across to London each year and I teach them, but sadly, as a result of the pandemic, I'm having to teach to China time. So I start work at 5 a.m. And it's tough for them and it's tough for me. I mean, teaching remotely, it has some merits, but I'm like you. I like to be in front of a crowd, because you can get to build up a proper relationship and a proper level of understanding. So yeah, it's an early night for me.
But we also know that despite your lack of alcohol drinking, your body clocks all over the place anyway. So it doesn't. I mean, 25 years of travelling the world, having adventures, it's clearly left you. Anyway, so my point is, we'll do one more story, and I've wasted more time by saying we shouldn't waste time. We'll do one more quick story, then on to the questions, all of which, of course, are very good. Now, Man City's parent company, the City Football Group, have bought their ninth club. And it's an odd choice, you'd imagine, given the high profile of some of the clubs they've bought before. They've bought a club called Lommel, who are in Belgian second tier. In the process, they've saved Lommel from bankruptcy, which is good. But why have they invested in a, let's face it, obscure Belgium second tier team?
Well, I think City are looking at the big picture. What they're trying to do within the City Football Group is to have continuity and consistency amongst all of the clubs when it comes to training, when it comes to looking for particular talents. And they're effectively using these overseas clubs as incubators. Now, as far as choosing one in Belgium is concerned, you've only got to look at Belgium's FIFA ranking. And it is clearly a country which is very good at developing young talent. It is going to be more difficult for players to move from Europe to the UK post Brexit. You know, we've seen the rulings that have come out, and it's going to be on a points based system. So I think City's approach is identify talent within Europe, get it to somewhere such as Belgium. If that player is good, then he's got a greater chance of getting international caps or getting a decent wage packet from elsewhere. And then City can sign him far easier than it would be from approaching other clubs in Europe when they are sort of talent spotting for the next Kevin De Bruyne.
And I presume the money involved in buying a Belgian second division club is literally, as we discussed at the start of the show, change down the back of the sofa for the City Group, is it?
Yes, relatively. We know that the City Group raised $500 million in November, December. They immediately bought Mumbai City, where a large chunk of that went, I think around about $400 million. Yeah, buying this club will be relatively cheap. As you said yourself, they paid off the club's debts. It had debts of 1.75 million euro. And I think the aim is to move forward with this idea of it helps to spread your costs, it helps to bring in talent, because if you're looking at signing for a regular Belgian club outside the two or three that qualify for UEFA competition, or this club, which has a pathway to Manchester City, you can actually see it being quite attractive from a player's perspective as well.
This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Now, I asked this question as a desperate attempt to claw back some credibility in terms of my research, because I was halfway through a bottle of wine and Union Berlin versus Bayern Munich when I realised I had this pod to record. But it suddenly occurred to me that, so Man City's parent company, the City Football Group, now have 9 football clubs. Do those clubs have financial independence within that group, or are their finances all controlled by the, so each club will presumably still have to do separate accounts, but within that, how much would Man City have independence from the City Football Group in terms of investments, in terms of, you know, broadcasting money, etc.?
I think Manchester City are very much the mothership as far as the CFG are concerned. So they do have full independence, because the aim, I think, initially is for City to get plenty of trophies and to increase its profile. In New York, I think there's a lot of independence as well. As far as some of the smaller clubs are concerned, they will be dictated to by head office in terms of how they do their negotiations, wage levels and things of this nature. But they still should be in a position to be very competitive locally, simply because of the wealth of the Abu Dhabi owners.
Now, on to our questions, because it is Monday, as we said, it's questions day. I've just been distracted by Kieran having a massive swig from his silver bottle of ice water, his one indulgence. Well, apart from Russian ladies in fur coats, of course. This is a very topical question from Matt Boothman. We're all Bundesliga fans this weekend, and it has been brilliant to see some form of, it generally has been great to see some form of live football. Social, economic arguments aside, it's been great to see football. Oddly, it didn't take long to adapt to the no atmosphere. Well, for you, Kieran, that would have been quite easy, I imagine. But Matt's question is, and it's a good question, with the Bundesliga starting back this weekend and getting TV money before any of the other European leagues, will that put them in pole position to cherry pick players in the transfer market? Have they got a head start?
It's yes and no. I think they've got a greater chance of survival until the end of the season. We've seen the Dutch leagues, the Belgian leagues, the French league all close down, and therefore those clubs won't have any money coming in. There will have to be rebates of TV broadcasting fees. So that's going to put them into a very delicate financial position. By the Bundesliga continuing, I don't think the clubs aren't going to be making profits, you know, but they will be reducing their losses. So relatively, I think the German Bundesliga clubs will be slightly better off than those from those countries which I've mentioned. And therefore, they should be in a slightly stronger position, especially if we move further down the summer and it looks as if the Bundesliga is going to start next season, and perhaps Belgium and the KNVB decide with the Eredivisie isn't going to take place in 2021. Then you can see Dutch, Belgian, French players perhaps being attracted to come to Germany because they can actually ply their wares.
Yeah. Okay. Jerry Pruitt, which is a great 70s sitcom name, Jerry Pruitt. I'm quoting here. Jerry says, "I have been very slowly and studiously absorbing the first two chapters of Kieran's book, not as slowly as me, Jerry, I have to say. It's, I don't know, older listeners may remember a classic, well, I won't have seen it first time, there's a classic Tony Hancock episode where he decides to educate himself and tries to read Bertrand Russell, and it takes him the whole episode to get through page one because he keeps having to go back and read it again. But Jerry, and well done for buying the book, Jerry, because especially as all the profits are going to a very good cause. But off the back of that, Jerry's made a very good point. He says you talk about myriad ways that clubs present their accounts. So would it be beneficial or indeed possible for the Premier League and the EPL to provide a template for standard presentation of financial reports?
I think it would be difficult because Manchester United, they are they're registered in the Cayman Islands. They are quoted on the New York Stock Exchange, and therefore they have to accede and comply with US legislation. Whereas here in the UK, that the other clubs are have to go and comply with UK legislation. But certainly there could be greater consistency. I think there's certainly. From my point of view, and you know, we all know that I am obsessive. I am a train spotter with football finance. There are things which some clubs are very good at displaying. So I think there could be a de minimis standard. The only trouble is when you have things of that nature, it tends to cause a rush to the bottom. And rather than best practice being followed, you tend to get, well, what's the minimum we can get away with? Some clubs are absolutely brilliant, very, very open. Others aren't. And as you know, I get very frustrated with those EFL clubs in the lower divisions. Today, I was asked to summarise the profitability of League Two. So I managed to do that for every club. But Oldham somehow made £6 million in profit, and there's no indication as to how they did that. So I just think from a transparency point of view, and going back to this sort of this old chestnut of ours, it's Oldham belongs to the fans of Oldham Athletic, not a Lebanese former football agent.
Yeah, well, in an ideal world, it does. Unfortunately, yeah. In the real world, it doesn't. But now I feel I should row you back there. Obviously, I understand what de minimis standards mean, but there may be one or two people listening to this pod who have to check that. So in order for them not to have to Google that, can you just explain what that means?
Well, it's probably sounds just a bad lowest common denominator. You say, well, if you've got to show at least 20 things and you list those out, but you might have some clubs who are already showing 40 or 50, and they might say, well, if everybody else can get away with showing just 20, perhaps we'll take a similar approach.
Right, okay. Our next question comes from Russell Earle. Thank you for your question, Russell. Again, I don't know why I say this. They're all good questions. Russell says one of our themes has been the influence of the betting industry on football, especially in the Premier League. We see so many clubs sponsored by betting companies. His question, if the season is voided or cancelled, will betting companies have to pay out or refund bets on promotion, top scorer bets, etc.? And will that affect their future investment in football, given that the betting industry must have lost a lot of money in the past 2 months?
I spoke to one of my friends this afternoon who's involved in the betting industry, and he says they've not made their mind up yet because they're awaiting a final decision. If those leagues which are declared null and void, I think there is a chance of some refunds rather than giving the payouts on the basis of what we've seen in the National League North and South and so on. If things continue in League One, then they will wait until some final resolution. Because if you think about it from the gambling company's point of view, the longer it is before the death bet is finalised, the more time that they've got the money in their pocket. In terms of how things go forward, that there's no doubt that the gambling industry has been hit really hard. It was very noticeable that some of the big four gamblers were piling in when the Korean J-League started last weekend. And the Bundesliga, again, the usual suspects are there very much promoting it. They make so much money. I think they can still afford to invest significant sums in football going forwards because it's that sort of that nature of the relationship that both parties are propping each other up to a certain extent.
My second favourite sport, the only other sport I really like is steeplechase, horse racing. And there are very strict rules in there. If a race is declared null and void for some reason, there are very strict rules about what refunds, etc. I presume the same rules apply in football, or do different gambling companies have different rules and regulations? Because if you bet on football, if you get one of those, you know, old football pool size coupons from a betting shop, if you turn it over on the back, there are very, very small rules and regulations which no punters ever read, I imagine. But are they standardised, or you know, does Paddy Power have different rules to Corals when it comes to refunds, etc.?
I think amongst the UK Big Four, that they're likely to be very consistent with one another. I think my concerns would be that we've had an influx of overseas gambling companies, which might come from different cultures, different local legislation rules, and that could impact upon their obligations to punters.
Now, this question comes from Liam Blaney. Hello, Liam. I'm going to give you an answer myself, which I think is rather clever, and I want you to mark me, because you may think I've been paying attention throughout the whole... I think we're coming up to our 50th pod, aren't we, I believe?
I think today is number 50.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Glanced at a WhatsApp group message, I don't know. It was, as I say, this afternoon, half time between Union Berlin and Bayern Munich. Union being my German team, of course. Liam says, what are your thoughts on football clubs no longer being run as companies, but instead being given charitable status, working on the basis that in this crisis, football clubs and both our clubs, you know, like many others, have been doing fantastic work in the community, feeding people, etc. So this idea of them being given charitable status. Now, my answer is, and I think you'll agree with me, is that if they were charities, they would have to be much, much stricter and on time with their financial reports, wouldn't they? Is that right?
That's right. The degree of regulation.
It was right.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a first for that. I'm actually grading assignments as every day at present. Yes, the Charities Commission does take a more forensic approach to the information which is produced by charities, and rightly so, because people donate to charities with a noble aim the vast majority of the time, and you don't want that money to be abused. So yes, I think the clubs would find themselves under a greater degree of scrutiny, and whether or not they would like that's a separate issue. Also, the cynic in me says that as a football fan, you know, as we're seeing with Newcastle United at present, you know, the prospect of rich foreign owners coming in and getting out a checkbook has got the fans very excited. Now, you couldn't do that if you were having to operate to the demands of the Charities Commission, who are saying, well, you can't lose too much money, you've got to aim to break even, and therefore that means you've got to have a fairly balanced budget in terms of recruitment and things of that nature.
What would the benefits be, though, if they were to become charitable companies?
Well, there could be some taxation benefits, but then the clubs that we're looking at, they all lose money, and therefore they don't pay any tax anyway. I think in terms of raising profile, raising funds, they might be able to tap into some other sources. But that's broadly it. You know, the whole point about a charity is that you are doing good in the community, and with the vast majority of the clubs in the Premier League and many in the EFL as well, having a community scheme, I'm not sure of the overall benefit on turning the whole club into effectively, you know, is it the tail wagging the dog?
Okay. Right, final question before you get your kit, before you do your 4,000 miles, how further?
It's a long way.
Is it? Yeah, okay. Let's settle on a long way. Chris Cairns has asked this question. With so many clubs placing non-playing staff on furlough, especially League One and League Two, could that lead to huge changes in how admin staff are used in future? And could more admin staff like marketing, ticketing, etc. be outsourced or done by one central agency or by the EFL itself, which strikes me as quite a sensible idea financially, doesn't it?
Certainly there are potential cost savings from spreading fixed costs over a greater number of people paying. My concern would be is that many clubs have a local relationship and therefore they know who to approach. If I am Walsall, I know the companies in the local vicinity who are potential sponsors. We know the reaction of fans, so therefore we can price tickets accordingly for if they've got a Tuesday match at home to somebody not very glamorous. And I think if you take that flexibility away from those clubs, then the cost savings might be overwritten by the loss of income and that lack of personal touch that you get, because you're effectively going through to a call centre for everything.
Yeah, also the other side of that is likewise that, you know, if I happen to need one extra ticket for a game against Burnley, I know exactly who in the ticket office I should be asking for that ticket. And also the clubs with their databases are very good at identifying people who may want to spread the season ticket cost across the season in three or four payments. And I suppose a centralised agency wouldn't have that flexibility, would it?
Absolutely, spot on.
Yeah. Anyway, so, well, that's the... it's flown by, isn't it? As things tend to do when you forgot you had a pod and you had a bottle of wine during the afternoon. I kind of knew we had a pod coming up sometime, but I didn't think it was as quickly as an hour after I'd... Anyway, I didn't actually fall asleep. I didn't have to be woken up. But it says here, if you like what you hear, please subscribe to The Price of Football in your podcast app and leave us a review or rating. But if you don't like what you hear, you won't still be listening, will you? So screw you guys. Also, I said podcast then, didn't I? That's shocking.
You did.
After having a go at you for saying elephant and castle, and I accidentally said podcast there. It's, you know, shocking. Podcast. If you have questions for us for our Monday pod, please email us on questions@priceoffootball.com. And as ever, we have been a Dap Dip production. Kieran, have a good long night talking to China. I'll be awake in 2 days' time, I imagine. And to everybody else listening, stay safe and stay well. Bye-bye now.
The Price of Football.
Bye-bye, folks.
The Price of Football.